We've just begun the seventh of the 7 points in the mind training here. And the seventh point, of course, is the precepts of mind training. The sixth point was the commitments. And the commitments were mainly to do with avoiding things that go against mind training. Whereas here the precepts are more to do with the things that can help support and nurture our mind training so that it can go deeper and further in the practice. And we've looked at the first of the slogans here, accomplish all yogas through a single means, meaning whatever practice we're doing, external or internal, the single means is through mind training. And mind training here, of course, is through the two bodhicittas, the wisdom and compassion of conventional bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta. And the next one is similar. Overcome all errors through a single means. So again, the single means is bodhicitta. So let's have a look at the commentary. It says, some who are under Mara's influence fail to develop confidence in the spiritual practice. They experience the false perceptions of misguided meditation practice with thoughts like, since I began practicing mind training, illness has increased, harms from demons have increased, people have become more hostile, and afflictions such as self-grasping have increased as well. Based on such thoughts, for no particular reason, they lose enthusiasm for mind training and are in danger of turning away. When this happens, you should become aware of it right there and then and think, a misguided meditative practice has arisen in me. With a second thought, you should reflect, there must be many beings like me in the universe whose thoughts have deviated from true Dharma practice, and take all of these deviations upon yourself and offer your body, wealth, and virtues to others. I imagine that because of this, the thoughts of others, of those others, turn toward the Dharma, and these others enter the unmistaken path. So a couple of things to comment here. One is, of course, is that often when people begin practicing, things seem to get worse. But actually, often it's the case that simply due to practice, we start to notice our negative thoughts, our distraction, our irritation. We notice all these things more because we are starting to become more mindful and trying to work with these negative states of mind. So often it's simply the case. In fact, often the very first sign of progress is to just simply notice how chaotic, out of control our mind is, how much our mind is actually under the influence of the mental afflictions. So often this is a sign of progress. And of course, if some mental affliction or some negative state of mind arises, then we can, as we did, looked earlier in the taking adverse conditions into the path, here we can use the Tonglen approach. Instead of allowing our mind to get caught up in this negativity or mental affliction, then we can simply understand there must be many other people with this similar negative state of mind, so we can take on all of that and send them happiness and imagine that they have found the true path. And of course here, also it's very helpful, of course, to have this qualified teacher, which comes up in one of the slogans very shortly, to help us, in fact, if in fact we are deviating from doing the practice in a correct way. Because this is also possible that, in fact, we're not doing the practice, whatever it is, in a correct way, and thereby may be experiencing some difficulties because of that. So for that, of course, a qualified teacher can be very helpful. They can really help us to overcome any faults in the way we do practices. So that's one of the slogans coming up over the page about relying on a qualified teacher. One other point here before we move on is Mara. We saw here about Mara. And here we can... sort of Mara is externalized as a sort of external demon. But actually, normally we can talk about the four Maras, and generally they're internal demons that obstruct the practice. So just briefly, because this is a fairly common presentation, just to briefly list the four Maras. So Maru is like a demon. And here it's the four Marus which obstruct practice. And often we talk about the four Marus that keep us trapped in samsara, that block us from achieving liberation. And we can talk about the Mara of the aggregates. The aggregates is the body and mind we have now, the contaminated body and mind. So we are continually reborn in this cycle of existence called samsara through the power of our actions, our mental afflictions and actions. So we keep cycling with these contaminated aggregates, the body and mind, that are projected through our mental afflictions and actions. So this is the Mara of the aggregates. And then we have the Mara, of course, of the mental afflictions. So, of course, it's the mental afflictions which the underlying cause of us cycling in samsara. And then, of course, we can talk about the Mara of death. Because death sort of interrupts the spiritual practice. So one way of going beyond samsara is mentioned is to go beyond the whole, to reach what's called a deathless state, to go beyond the cycle of birth, aging and death. And then the fourth one is usually listed as Devaputra, sort of son of the god. Deva sort of often translated as god, but of course not creator god. And putra means child or son, so son of the god. And sometimes that's externalized as some being. And so poetically in the text, it says that this Devaputra is there firing the arrows of the mental afflictions into us. But when we really look at that, what we're really talking about here is a very specific mental affliction that keeps us trapped, particularly in this desire realm, which is sensual desire. Desiring the sense pleasures. Because this is really the mental affliction that is the driving force in our life. And that's why we're sort of stuck in this desire realm, because of this sensual craving, sensual desire. So these are the four Maras that keep us trapped in samsara. And then there's no questions. We'll move on to the next point.
Can you please, the first one again?
The aggregates, of course, is the body and the mind. So the body and the mind that we have, this is the five aggregates. So it's called the contaminated aggregates. It's the aggregates that are created through the contaminated, through the mental afflictions. So we have a contaminated mind and contaminated body. And that's what's actually cycling in samsara. So we want to go beyond these contaminated aggregates. Okay. Then if we go on to the next slogan, there are two tasks, one at the start and one at the end. So in general, of course, here we're talking about at the start of any virtuous activity to set a good motivation, and then at the end of that activity to dedicate. And of course here, in the Mahayana, we're really talking about the highest type of motivation, which of course is bodhicitta, and then dedicating towards the goal of enlightenment. But here in the commentary, it lays out really how we can do this in terms of structuring the day, how we can start the day and end the day. So I think there's some very good practical advice here, so let's have a look at that. In the morning, after getting up, you should project the thought, throughout this day I shall make sure I don't become tainted by the clinging of self-cherishing. I shall make sure that thoughts cherishing others do not degenerate. So here, then at the start, the beginning of the day, is to set a good motivation for the day. And as the very well-known motivation that from His Holiness Dalai Lama is, the short version of that, of course, is think as you wake up, today I'm going to benefit others as much as I can. So if we have that thought every morning, I think we'll set off the day in a good way, to start the day in a good way. Then during the day, remain sustained by vigilance that accompanies everyday activity. So here, vigilance is very similar to this idea of mindfulness, of course, is to really be mindful of everything we do through the day. And this is something I'm going to talk a little bit more about tomorrow morning. But I've already mentioned a number of times in this course is that if we really want to implement any of these practices, particularly in terms of integrating them into daily life, we need mindfulness. Because if we don't have mindfulness, then no matter how much we want to change our habits and our behavior through the day, it's not really going to happen, because we're going to simply receive a stimulus and before we know it, we react out of a habit, our old habits. So it's going to be very difficult to change those habits if we don't have some mindfulness. So therefore, if we do the shamatha practice well and we work on mindfulness through the day, then we have an opportunity to implement some of these ideas about how to particularly take adverse conditions into the path, for example, mentioned here earlier. And I'll speak a bit more about this tomorrow morning. Then, when going to bed at night, while in the meditative absorption, lion's majestic pose, so we saw that was that lying on the right side, the same posture that's often taught in terms of transitioning through the death process. And we see the same when the Buddha passed away, he was in that posture on the right side. Consequently, review the day by recalling, first I did this, then I did that, and so on. If you detect any transgression, it is stated, at that instant enumerate your flaws and recall your teacher's instructions. Then cultivate the following thought. Isn't it amazing that there are people like me who waste their precious human existence and bring harm upon themselves? Thinking thus, appeal for forbearance, declare and purify your negative karma, and cultivate the resolve to forsake this in future. So here, and I think I've mentioned this already, when we talked about purification earlier, is in a very practical way, when we're going to bed at night, before we go to sleep, is to review the day, as suggested here, and review our day, how did our day go? And if we notice if we've done any harmful negative behavior, then do as suggested here, is go through this purification practice, these four opponent powers that we looked at a couple of times in this course, the regret, the reliance in terms of going for refuge, generating bodhicitta, some sort of practical remedy, and then make a strong resolve not to engage in that harmful behavior again. So this is very helpful at the end of the day to purify our mind of that negative habit and those negative imprints. But then also here it says, if you have not committed any transgression, then rejoice thinking, I have indeed made my human existence meaningful. Dedicate the virtue toward the aspiration to realize this practice in your mental continuum. Also make the aspirational prayer, may I never be divorced from the two awakening minds throughout all my lives. So here also then, review the day and then look at all the good things we did during the day and rejoice in the good things we've done and make a strong determination to continue to do these good actions. And then we can also dedicate all the good things we've done during the day toward the goal of continuing to practice these two bodhicittas. And also here, we can make that aspirational prayer we saw in the five powers to meet with qualified teachers, particularly if we don't have a qualified teacher now. May I meet with qualified teachers who can help and guide me in this path. So this is some very practical, helpful advice about how to structure the day. And I'll talk a little bit more about this again tomorrow morning. Any questions about that?
In this book, I think there's a typo where it says lying down, lying posture, which entails on left side with our left hand underneath.
So yeah, it's usually on the right side.
It would be a typo.
Yeah, usually it's talked about lying on the right side. Yeah. But of course also what we need to remember is that particularly in the level of tantric practice, we have what's called Father Tantra and Mother Tantra. And each one emphasizes either the wisdom or the compassion wing. And because of that, they emphasize the right or the left. So sometimes it could be that we see something in the level of Tantra we do with in terms of right, you know, like the 9-round breathing exercise, usually we start with the right, but then in that you would start with the left. So it could be that this is also...
But this talks about, say, lying down, lying posture.
Yeah, so usually right side.
Right.
Okay, then if we go to the next slogan, forbear whichever of the two arises. And this is, again, I think about not getting caught up in these eight worldly concerns, not getting caught up in this sort of hoping for pleasant things and fearing or worrying about unpleasant things. Because then if we have pleasant things, we develop a lot of craving and attachment. If they're unpleasant, a lot of aversion. So here, this can help us to overcome this a little bit. It says, if you suddenly come into great fortune, do not become arrogant or attached to it. Make sure you do not fall prey to the eight mundane concerns. You should take this fortune as a basis for your Dharma practice. Some people who attract followers and material gifts become conceited by this. They then despise others and do whatever comes to mind. You must discard such behavior. So again, if we find ourselves having some favorable conditions arising in our life, not to be develop craving and attachment for those, but use those favorable experiences to go further in the practice, to go deeper into the practice. Likewise, if you experience misfortune, such as the only thing that seems beneath you is the water flowing under a bridge, and maybe that's a little bit of a Tibetan expression, do not become depressed. I think we can understand what it means. Do not become depressed or demoralized, wondering how such an unfortunate person like me could exist. Do not be so downcast you're incapable of training the mind. So here, again, to not then develop this aversion or depression or something because we're having difficult situations or not a lack of good conditions. Because particularly remember here in this mind training, we're developing the ability to take these adverse conditions into the path. And one of the things that was mentioned earlier was to keep that joyful mind no matter what the conditions are. Instead, reflect, compared to the contrast in degree and intensity between happiness of the higher realms and suffering of the lower realms of existence, the contrast between pleasant and unpleasant states of human existence are not so immense. So without further distraction, I shall focus on my spiritual practice. For it is taught, even if you are prosperous like the gods, pray not to be conceited. Even if you become as destitute as a hungry ghost, pray not to be disheartened. So again here, to really... turn that perspective is not about what we can get from the world, but what we can bring to the world. To get over this eight worldly concerns, to get over this attachment to pleasant things, aversion to unpleasant things. And thereby, whatever the conditions are, if they're good conditions, use them to go deeper into the practice. If they're adverse conditions, use them to go deeper into the practice. So we can use whatever conditions we have. Then the next slogan is, guard the two even at the cost of your life. So what are the two things that we are to guard here? So let's have a look. There are the precepts and commitments presented in the teaching in general. So again, here we're talking about the precepts or commitments that we have taken in general. Maybe we've taken these five lay vows, the pratimoksha vows, maybe we've taken some bodhisattva vows or even tantric vows. So of course, to maintain this, because ethical basis is really the basis of all practice. And then it says here, Such as do not speak of the defects of others. The second one is the commitments of this particular mind training teaching, such as do not speak of the defects of others. Since even the mundane happiness in this present life will elude you, if these two commitments become degenerate, hold them more dearly than your life. So again, here is to maintain the ethical basis in general that we have adopted through whatever level of practice that we are following. And then, of course, also here in the last chapter, the last point, point six, the commitments, again, to maintain those commitments as well, the mind training commitments, because here these mind training commitments are also helping us to avoid anything that goes opposite to mind training. So these are the two things that we are to guard and maintain. Then we have the next point here. It says, train in the three difficult challenges. So here the difficult challenges are to do with the mental afflictions and trying to overcome mental afflictions, which is not so easy, can be a little bit difficult. So let's see what the three difficult challenges are. When eliminating the afflictions, in the beginning, it can be difficult to remember the antidotes. I think even one thing before that, that we can add to the three difficult challenges. And the first one is, it can be difficult to notice the afflictions arising in the first place. So this, of course, is mindfulness. So I think if we want to be able to implement or overcome these three difficult challenges, first, of course, we need to be aware that the mental affliction is arising. So therefore, again, mindfulness. So in the beginning, it can be difficult to remember the antidote. So of course, then we need to remember what to do if a particular mental affliction has arisen. So therefore, it's good to learn and remember the very particularly in specific antidotes for afflictions. And of course, we've got more general antidotes as well. You know, the more the general, the wisdom and the compassion sort of antidotes to afflictions in general. But of course, it's very good to learn and know how to apply specific antidotes to specific mental afflictions. So we've come across a few already in this course. So one we mentioned was for anger. One antidote, of course, is patience, to keep that undisturbed mind in the face of a difficult situation. And then, of course, for attachment, one antidote was impermanence. And remember, we saw that one antidote for, particular antidote for jealousy was to rejoice in others, rejoicing in others. And we saw also one antidote for this pride or arrogance was to reflect on suffering. So these are a few examples that we've looked at a little bit in this course. So it's good to be aware of these very specific antidotes, but then of course more general antidotes in terms of either using the ultimate bodhicitta or conventional bodhicitta as an antidote. And we can use that both of those can be used as an antidote to all mental afflictions. In the middle, it can be difficult to overcome the afflictions, and at the end, it can be difficult to eradicate the continuum of afflictions. Therefore, make sure you accomplish these three without great difficulty. To train, first thing in the morning, put on the armor with respect to all three stages. So, to put on the armor with all respect to these three stages is, again, to make a determination to not allow the mental afflictions to take hold of our mind. Remember the analogy here, the Tibetan analogy of if the pig of the mental afflictions puts its snout through the door of the mind, you whack it on the head. So therefore, this idea, when the affliction actually arises, so remember we need mindfulness to notice that it's arising, recall their antidotes, And then counter them, so it means to overcome the affliction with the antidote, and cultivate the resolve, from here on I shall never allow the afflictions to arise in my mind. So to eradicate the continuum of the mental afflictions, again, we saw that in the four opponent powers, that to eliminate the habit, because the antidote is eliminating the mental affliction, but also we're wanting to eliminate the continuum or the habit of them. So therefore, two things can be very helpful here. One, to make a strong resolve again to not allow that mental affliction to arise or to take control of our mind. So that's that fourth of the four opponent powers, the resolve, and that can really help to break the habit. And then, of course, the two bodhicittas as well. Conventional and ultimate bodhicitta. Particularly the ultimate bodhicitta, the wisdom of emptiness, of course, will eliminate all negative imprints in our mind. So that's also the longer-term strategy, of course, to overcome this continuum of the mental afflictions or the habit of them arising again and again. Any questions? Okay, I'll keep going then. Adopt the three principal conditions. So here is three very important points. Three very general, but very important. The three principal conditions for spiritual practice. So what are the three main conditions we need for spiritual practice? First, there should be a qualified spiritual teacher who possesses the pith instructions and is endowed with higher realizations. The bond between the teacher and you should be so close that no dog can come between. Again, it's a Tibetan expression. And the teacher should be pleased with you. So maybe there's a few things I can mention here that will be helpful. Do we need a qualified teacher?
Yes.
Of course, if we had unlimited time, we could probably eventually progress very well without a teacher. But the reality is, of course, we don't have unlimited time. So we want to make effective time, use of our time. And so that's why a qualified teacher is very helpful, because they can help save us wasting a lot of time either doing practices incorrectly, not doing the right practices, and also, of course, helping us to overcome obstacles in our practice. And they can also tailor the practices for us. They can really tailor the practices and give us very personal advice that can make it most effective. So a teacher can really save us a lot of time. And of course, traditionally how it would work would be that the teacher would give us some instructions. We would go off and implement those for some time, maybe some weeks or months. We would then come back to them and report what happened. And then based on our feedback, they would then adjust those instructions. And then there would be this constant sort of feedback loop. Now, how should we relate to the teacher? And here, it's off the analogy that I find very helpful is the analogy of a fire. If we're too close to a fire, we get burnt. If we're too far from a fire, we don't receive any warmth. If we're too close to a teacher, we get burnt. If we're too far from the teacher, we don't receive the warmth of inspiration and guidance. What does it mean to be too close and get burnt? We can get burnt in at least two ways if we're too close to the teacher. One is that if we have too easy access to a teacher, there's a great danger that from our side, we use the teacher to absolve personal responsibility. Meaning anytime we have to make a decision, I'll ask the teacher. And so we run off to the teacher every time we have to make a decision. But of course, If we do that, we're going to end up in this codependency relationship, which is very unhealthy. And of course, if a teacher is qualified and they see us running to them just every time we have a little question, they'll actually get quite harsh on us and tell us, go away and sort it out yourself. Because the role of the teacher, and the teacher sometimes can be called the outer guru, the role of the teacher is to awaken the inner guru within us, our own Buddha nature, our own inner wisdom, which now, of course, is heavily obscured by mental afflictions. And so we need the help of a teacher to remove those mental afflictions so that that inner guru can manifest more and more and we can become more and more self-reliant. So actually, the outer guru's job is to make themselves out of a job. But in the short term and medium term, of course, we need to rely on them, because the inner guru is so heavily obscured and we can't really use our own inner wisdom very much. So that's one way we can get burnt if we're too close, is that, we just keep running to the teacher every time we have a small question. And the other way we can get burnt if we're too close is, again, because we tend to be heavily obscured by mental afflictions, then what often can happen is we start to project faults onto the teacher when in fact there are none there. We start to see faults when there are none there. But of course, related to that is, if the teacher gives us instructions and we believe that these instructions are unethical, we must not follow that advice under any circumstance. We must go to the teacher and ask them, why is this not unethical? And if they can't give us a satisfactory answer, we must not follow that advice. Because if we do, we're not a qualified student. Because one of the qualities of a qualified student is what's called discriminating wisdom, the ability to check instructions, like a goldsmith. If we're not checking and we're just blindly following the advice of the teacher, we are not a qualified student. So we need to check it out. Of course, if we've checked out the teacher thoroughly before accepting them, then generally they're qualified and they won't be giving us unethical advice. So usually this only happens if we don't check out a teacher and we just jump in when we see the first person that maybe is famous or has a lot of followers and go, that's the teacher for me. And then, of course, we start receiving some advice and suddenly we find that they're not qualified really. And in fact, they may be trying to exploit us. And then, of course, if we find that, then we need to cut from that teacher and have nothing more to do with them. And certainly, if it's unethical, we must not follow that advice. Unfortunately, we see this so much in the modern world. We see people who have turned into a spiritual ego and not only puffed up state of mind, but often then become very unethical and then use their pretending to be qualified teachers to exploit others. So, and we see this a lot. So we need to be very careful. We don't fall into that trap. So we need to check out the teacher thoroughly before accepting them. And another thing that is important here and generally recommended is to only have one personal teacher. Of course, we can go to a number of teachers to get general teachings from. Good. But when it comes to personal advice, it's best to have one. That's the general advice. Because if we have more than one teacher we get personal advice from, and then we receive different personal advice from two teachers that seems to be contradictory, what are we going to do? We get confused. And often what can happen is, if we have more than one personal teacher, is we go to a teacher for advice, and often the very advice that they give us, the thing they want us to do, is the one thing that we've been avoiding, because it's the one thing we really need to work on. And then when we hear that, we go, "Ooh, I don't want to do that." And then we run away to another teacher. And then they'll probably ask the same, they'll tell us the same advice. We don't like that sound of that. Keep running until we find a teacher that says something nice. We go, "Oh yes, I like that, I'll do that." That's not in our best interest. So therefore, only to have one personal teacher. And there was something else I wanted to add on that, but now it's slipped my mind. Yes, if we go to a teacher for personal advice, then we better be prepared to follow that advice. Because if we're not, then we're not being sincere. Of course, if it seems to be unethical, we must not follow it. But if we're asking for personal advice, then we better be prepared to implement that. Otherwise, we're just playing a game. We're not being sincere. We're not really asking for advice. We're just wanting someone to say something to confirm what we think is the right thing to do. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for someone to confirm that what we're doing is the right thing, and we're not really listening to their advice. So therefore, I think this is how we should approach it. Any questions about teacher?
They express it like it should be so close that a dog cannot pass through.
The bond.
Yeah.
Meaning.
It means
our faith and respect. It doesn't mean that we have to be physically so close so no dog can walk between us. It means that. We have such a strong connection with the teacher in terms of faith and respect that can't be broken by something else. It doesn't mean physically close, because again, if we're too physically close, we can have these difficulties. And again, the whole point of the teacher is to make ourselves more and more self-reliant. So we don't need to be very close to the teacher. But again, if we're too far from the teacher, we don't receive the warmth, we don't receive inspiration, we don't receive personal instruction. So it would be good to be able to see the teacher at least a couple of times a year, personally. And then in between times, if we have difficulties, now with modern technology, we can just email them and say, I've got this problem, what can I do? So even if the teacher's on the other side of the planet, we can communicate via email and so forth if we have some big difficulty in our practice. So that's also possible.
So in that time, usually the monks were living together. And today, if you find a qualified teacher, he should know you. So does that...
Well, initially they won't know you, but that's why part of the checking out process is they check us out as well. Because the thing is, from their side, they need to have time to be able to help you. Maybe they've already got a couple of hundred students, so then they haven't got time to help you. Or they may find that your needs are outside of the scope of how they can help you. Maybe you're following a slightly different tradition and they're not familiar with that, so then they would send you to someone else. Or in some cases, if a student progresses very quickly, they may actually even surpass the level of the teacher. And then if that happens, the teacher will often say to the student, okay, I can no longer help you. I recommend you go to see this person. So this is also possible.
A qualified teacher can so quickly understand you?
If they're really qualified, they can read your mind. Really. They know you better than you. And sometimes, and I've had a little bit that experience sometimes, when you're in the presence of a teacher and then they say something and it's obvious that, it seems like they've read your mind, because what they're saying is what you just thought. I mean, sometimes it can be coincidence, but sometimes it's really freaky. So... I mean, of course, the Buddhist assertion is as we purify the mind, we will develop that capacity to be able to read people's minds. And that is one of the qualities that is helpful as a teacher, is to be able to read people's minds, because then you know exactly what they need.
Decided that you want to follow, His Holiness teaching. So you can, in a way you don't have to be, see His Holiness three, four times a year, just to, you know, feel that he is in a way your teacher.
No, I mean, that's what I said, is you can have many general teachers. And of course, if we want to follow the Lojong approach, everyone is our teacher.
Yeah.
Particularly those who try to harm us, they are often our best teachers. So if we can have that attitude, we can learn from everybody, particularly the ones, people who challenge us. They're often our best teachers.
Yeah. So you don't have to have, you know, this teacher and then, you know, decide that he's your teacher and now you're like, in a way, following only him. You can...
No, but I'm here, I'm talking about personal instruction, when you go to them and ask for personal instruction.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, most of us don't have access to His Holiness Dalai Lama for personal instruction.
But, for instance, if, I don't know, like, if I'm going to a course and I want to have, you know, a conversation with the teacher that is leading this course.
Sure.
So it's kind of, in a way...
Well, often that is in terms of just clarifying the teaching. So that's very general.
No, like, okay, with the course that we did with Robina.
Sure.
She provided, you know, personal... meetings with
them. Sure.
So it's like, in a way...
Sure. And that can be the first step to this student-teacher relationship, that you go and see them, you talk to them, and you make an interaction with them, and they checking you, you're checking them, and maybe they give you some instructions, and then you can go on that. And then at some point, you gain faith and confidence that this person is really the one who can really give me very good personal advice. And then often how that relationship begins can be very formal, a formal request, or it can just be more organic over time, that it sort of develops into that sort of thing, relationship. Mm-hmm. So both is possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a Tibetan tradition, often the Tibetan tradition, when you request someone to be your teacher, their teacher, they traditionally say no 3 times. And I mean, this good, because often people do it a little bit sort of without any, do it very superficially.
Yeah.
So then if you get rejected and you don't come back, you were just being superficial. So generally, often the Tibetans would say no 3 times. And if you keep coming back, then they see that you're sort of really earnest about your request. You're not just sort of doing it superficially.
Clairvoyance means ability to read people's minds.
Mm. Yes.
But that is like before you can reach the state before enlightenment.
Clairvoyance has got nothing to do with the Buddhist path. It's about shamatha practice. Shamatha is not Buddhist practice. It's concentration, which is common to many traditions. We can develop clairvoyance through concentration, shamatha practice. Clairvoyance, there are a number of abilities there. Remembering past lives, reading other people's minds, what's called remote viewing, seeing things at a distance. All of these things are possible through the shamatha practice. So this is not anything Buddhist. It's just through concentration skills.
So you say that even like a normal person can reach those states in his life?
Yeah, if we develop this... Well, actually, I briefly mentioned that there are a number of levels of concentration. There's shamatha, and then above that, there are these 4 jhanas that are often talked about in Theravada. In the text, it says if you develop the jhana, the first one, then you can easily develop these abilities. They don't come automatically. You still have to do some practice, but on the basis of that jhana... It's quite easy to develop these abilities, it said. Reading people's minds, remembering past lives, remote viewing, all of this is easy to develop on that basis. And again, that's nothing particularly Buddhist. It's just concentration skill. Okay, let's move on then. So the first is to have a teacher. The second is your state of mind should be such that many realizations have arisen, from the rarity of precious human existence to the understanding of no self, and these should have arisen just as contemplated or as taught by your teacher. So here, what it's saying is that we need a qualified teacher. And the second point is saying, then we should follow their advice. We should listen. We should reflect. We should meditate and internalize these and come to realize these instructions. So here, the second one is talking about those three stages of go nyam tok, of listening, contemplating, meditating, to come to realize. So again, second point is to put these instructions into practice, internalize them, come to realize them. And then the third condition that is necessary for practice is conditions conducive to Dharma practice must be gathered, such as faith, intelligence, joyous effort, a strong sense of disenchantment towards cyclic existence, food and clothing and other necessities. So here, of course, some of these conducive conditions mentioned here are the preliminary practices in terms of precious human life and death, and particularly here, this strong sense of disenchantment towards cyclic existence was the fourth of the preliminary practices to come to realize dukkha. And then, of course, it talks also about conducive conditions such as food and clothing and so forth. Since these three are the principal conditions of Dharma practice, if you possess them, rejoice and strive especially to enhance them. If you do not possess them, contemplate. And here we see the Tonglen practice again. How sad. The vast expanse of the universe must contain countless others like me who lack these three factors and have failed in their Dharma practice. Thinking thus, take upon yourself all their deficiencies as you offer your body and so on. Then imagine they obtain the three conditions that are all experience the great vehicle, the Mahayana. So again, here we can, instead of having aversion to the fact that we don't have these conditions, we can use the Tonglen practice again here. So these are the three principal conditions for practice: to have a teacher, to follow their advice, to internalize, to come to realize, and then gather conducive conditions for practice. Any questions?
What is Mahamudra? Where is it fitting in with Vipassana or
Shamatha? Of course, Shamatha and Vipassana are the two, there's the three main core practices in all traditions is ethics, concentration, wisdom, or Shila, Shamatha, Vipassana, Shila, Samadhi, Pranya. So they're the three core practices in all traditions. Particularly the Vipassana looks a bit different depending on if it's emptiness, no self or so, but they're the three core practices. Mahamudra is the system of practice in the Mahayana within the Kagyu school of Tibetan Buddhism. It's a particular approach to Mahayana practice, just like Lojong is a particular approach to Mahayana practice. Similar, another approach to Mahayana practice is Lam Rim, stages of path to enlightenment. Another approach to Mahayana practice we find in Tibetan Buddhism is Dzogchen, very close to Mahamudra. Another approach in Tibetan Buddhism to Mahayana practice is Lamdre, paths and result within the Sakya tradition. These are all different ways of packaging the same core areas of practice of ethics, concentration, wisdom. Okay, then if we move to the next point, contemplate the three that are free of degeneration. So what are the things that we should not allow to degenerate? Since all the attainments of the Mahayana depend on the student's faith and respect toward his or her teacher, make sure you are never divorced at any time from the perception of your teacher as a Buddha. In this manner, make sure that your faith and respect toward your spiritual teacher remain undiminished. So here, one of the things that we want to not allow to degenerate is our faith and respect toward our teacher.
What?
To not allow it to degenerate is to continue to have faith and respect for our teacher. The second thing here is, says, furthermore, with the thought, the mind training teaching represents the quintessence of Mahayana. It is like a potent seed of Buddhahood. Engage in this incomparable practice. Thus, make sure your enthusiasm for mind training remains undiminished. So the second thing that we are not to allow to degenerate is our enthusiasm for mind training practice. And we can maintain that enthusiasm for this practice, particularly by reflecting on the benefits of the practice, and also, of course, letting go of any expectations. And then we can really have joy in the practice by seeing all these benefits, as long as we're not grasping onto having craving and attachment for achieving those results. And then the third one, it says here, as for the pledges of the great and lesser vehicle, so this is the Mahayana and Theravada that you have taken, you should, by sailing the great ship of shame and conscientiousness, which are the true antidotes, learn to guard them undiminished, not tainted by even the slightest infractions. So again, here, yet again, we see that one of the things that we are not allowed to degenerate is these pledges and vows, means the ethical basis for our practice, to not allow that to degenerate. So these are the things that we are to not allow to degenerate: faith and respect in our teacher, enthusiasm and joy in the mind training practice, and the ethical basis that we have adopted in our practice. Then we go to the next point. Be endowed with the three inseparable factors. So what are we to be inseparable of? Make sure that your body is never divorced from such virtuous acts as offering services to your spiritual teachers, making offerings to the three jewels, offering torment cakes to Dharma protectors and elemental spirits, making prostrations, performing circumambulations, and so on. So here we're talking about virtuous physical activities. Make sure that your speech is never divorced from such virtuous acts as reciting verses on taking refuge, repeating mantras, and doing recitations. Make sure that your mind is never divorced from the two awakening minds and is endowed with inconceivable courage to vanquish all the conceptualizing afflictions such as self-cherishing. So here the summary of this, all of this is, in brief, make sure your body, speech, and mind are never divorced from virtuous activity at all times. So I think this is fairly obvious that the to be endowed with the three inseparable factors means to make sure that we are always endowed with virtuous activity in terms of physical, verbal, mental. So that's, I think, pretty obvious. Sure.
Can you give a word about mantras, circumambulations, and prostration? Is it just a method of technique, or there is something under it?
Well, hopefully there's something under it, because if there's nothing under it...
A good technique.
Yeah. I mean, if there's nothing under it, then circumambulation might be some useful cardiovascular exercise. That's okay. And chanting mantra may be... sort of calms the mind a little bit because it's some melodious sound. But yes, there needs to be something under it, meaning that, again, the key element in all of these verbal and physical practices is what's going on in the mind. If we're mindlessly reciting mantras and we're mindlessly walking around a stupa, again, not a lot of benefit. Slight, maybe. Maybe we're actually getting frustrated that we have to do this or something. You know, we're getting irritated that we've got a commitment to recite these mantras or a commitment to walk around the stupa so many times, and then we go, I have to do this. You know, I made this commitment. Then, of course, it actually becomes negative activity. So, it's what's underneath. It's what is going on in the mind that is the key element. And then often these verbal and physical activities are simply there to support what the actual practice is. You know? So the chanting mantra comes usually within a whole practice, and that chanting a mantra often is for a particular purpose, and the mantra itself has a particular meaning. So we need to know why we're reciting the mantra, what is the context, so that the mantra recitation is an aid to whatever the practices we're doing. And similarly with the circumambulation is really what's going on in the mind that's going to determine whether this is a virtuous activity or not. Similarly with prostrations, you know, if we're mindlessly doing prostrations, again, maybe good cardiovascular exercise, but that's about it. So again, it's what's going on in the mind. And often, particularly with these preliminary practices, one of the practices that you often see in Tibetan Buddhism are prostrations, and they're usually done together with the refuge and bodhicitta prayer. So the main part of the practice there is going for refuge and generating bodhicitta, and not just verbally saying the verse mindlessly, but thinking about actually going for refuge and actually cultivating the aspiration of bodhicitta. That's the practice. Supporting that, we do some prostrations, which can help by physically going down, it can help subdue the pride and arrogance as well. But the main practice is what's going on in the mind. In this case, often we're doing this going for refuge, generating bodhicitta. But again, if we're just mindlessly, you know, doing prostrations, again, good cardiovascular exercise, and that's about it.
Yoga.
No?
Yeah, it was for me clear that this is the answer, but I'm asking about, like, inside the stupa there is relics, or like kind of...
So again, generally a stupa, like the one here, is for Lama Yeshe, the founder of this organization. So if you know who Lama Yeshe was and you're walking around the stupa, then hopefully you can remind you of that and be inspired by what he achieved and what he did. So by walking around the stupa, you can develop an inspirational state of mind, for example. And of course, stupas, each part of the stupa is symbolizing like enlightened body, speech, mind, and all sorts of things. So if you understand the symbolism as well, then you can draw on that and also remind us of what we are to do in the practice and receive inspiration as well. So this is what can be helpful if we're walking around a stupa.
So all of these things, also mantras, working help you to work on your mind, but they don't have like external powers.
Of course, we can talk about the interconnected nature of reality, and other people and even things can affect us mentally. We know that well. You know, when we see certain things, it has a great impact on our mind, either positive or negative. So also this can have a direct positive impact on the mind. But again, for that to happen, it would be helpful to understand the significance of the stupa and the symbolism and so forth. Then it can really have a direct positive impact on the mind when we see that. But otherwise, if we don't understand it, we go, oh, that looks nice. And then, okay, it's okay.
This is like with art in a way, you know. Before I studied like art, I always saw Picasso's, you know, drawing like, you know, Guernica. What is that? I mean, that's kids are doing this. And then when I learned about it and learned how sophisticated he was and what it symbolizes, so today I can look at the Guernica in a totally different look.
Sure.
In a way.
Yeah, and exactly. That's why it's important that whatever practice we do, we understand what the practice is and the reason we're doing it, and not just sort of mindlessly follow other people. You know, we see other people, you know, chanting a mantra, so we just start chanting a mantra, which is okay. I mean... Maybe it's better to chant a mantra than think about all sorts of negative things in our mind, but that might be a slight improvement. But again, if we're just mindlessly going on Mani Padme Hum, then, you know, okay. But, I mean, maybe we should learn what the practice is about and then really get a lot of benefit from doing that practice. You know, it might be useful. Okay, one more point and then we'll break for afternoon tea. So... the next one, train constantly toward the chosen objects. So here, of course, we are in general doing mind training towards with everyone. But here it's talking about there's two particular types of objects or people that are particularly powerful that we can pay close attention to. So let's see what they are. It is stated that being angry and vengeful towards enemies and adversaries who are right there in your presence comes about on the basis of frequent interactions. Thus, from one angle, there is a real risk of losing your mind training in relation to those who simply appear repulsive, those who harbour ill will against you, even though you have caused them no harm, and those who you find undesirable, even though they harbour no ill will toward you. Therefore, single these persons out for special focus and train your mind by perceiving them as parts of your own heart. Furthermore, because your spiritual teachers, parents, and bodhisattvas are objects of special significance, the fruitional effects are inconceivably grave if you accumulate negative karma in relation to them. Single them out for special focus and engage in the training. So there are two types of persons we can sort of single out in particular. First is the adversary, the so-called enemy, for two reasons. One is that, of course, we can easily react in a negative way towards them, so we need to pay attention to that. And secondly, of course, they are the very person that help us to develop compassion, patience, and so forth. So they're a very powerful object for those two reasons. So they're, in particular, focus on them. And then the other persons or persons to focus on are those persons who have shown us great kindness, our teachers, our parents, bodhisattvas, and so forth, is to really focus on those people as well. So that's what's being mentioned here. Because particularly if we do negative behavior towards those very people who've been most kind to us, then that is quite a heavy negative behavior and will have heavy negative results. But also, of course, these people are the ones who benefit us most, so therefore, to really pay particular attention to them. Yes?
Often we don't have only one stance toward a person, but are kind of, I think the word is biased. Like, a person has benefited you or shown you kindness, but the same person has hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
So, in one person, you find both aspects,
sure,
of the friend of the enemy. How to practice on this?
Well, then when they're harming us, we can take the adverse conditions. They're helping us to practice patience and compassion. And when they're helping us, then we're having good conditions to go further in the practice. So win-win, you know.
But if these actions are like in the past, most actions we reflect upon are actions in the past. Because
Sure.
So could we do Tonglen in both directions on them, like using them as friend and enemy at the same
time? Yeah, I mean, of course, regardless of how they're behaving toward us, then we can use Tonglen, of course, because if they're behaving badly toward us, then instead of reacting, we can take that from them, that mental affliction, and give them happiness. But also, of course, if they're behaving well towards us, they still have mental afflictions and suffering, so we can take on that and send them happiness. So regardless of how they're behaving towards us, of course we can use the Tonglen practice towards them. Of course. Sure. Okay. Let's break for afternoon tea. Come back. And then we've got 10 or so verses to go to finish the text.